There are warnings of a worsening funding crisis facing the disability sector and serious unmet need. After three pilot projects brought thousands of eligible people out of the woodwork. In its latest report to the sector, the Disability Support Network estimates at least 15,000 people don't access help that they are eligible for. That's based on feedback from pilot projects in Palmerston North, Waikato and Christchurch, which, while deemed successes in the delivery of flexible services, also experienced the emergence of another 25% of people coming forward on top of those who are currently in the system. Those people were disproportionately from Māori, Pacific, rural and poor backgrounds. The Disability Support Network, which is made up of over 160 support organisations, says the findings are troubling. They lay bare, it says, a complex disability system which is very effective at hiding and suppressing need. And, they estimate, is over half $1 billion short every year in baseline funding. Meanwhile, last week the government announced an acceleration of 25 programs that are still at the planning stage or have stalled, with issues of education, employment, health and accessibility all set to be addressed, which it says will help 1 million New Zealanders. Here to work through all this, the Disability Support Network's Chief Executive Garth Benny. Good morning.
Good morning.
First, could we talk at what was known as the Enabling Good Lives Project pilots? These three pilots, one in Palmerston North, one in Waikato, one in Christchurch. What did they do?
Well, what they were set up to do was to look at what kind of system was needed to support a set of principles known as Enabling Good Lives. And they're a great set of principles. And the pilots are all about designing and testing a disability system that will support those principles rather than get in the way of them.
This was ultimately, hopefully, to lead to a national rollout of a complete redesign of the system. It was called system transformation,
that's
I think,
right,
in the lingo. And what would it mean if you were a person in the system now? What changed when you went through the pilot? And what hopefully would change for everyone were it to be proved successful?
Well, what it means is that disabled people and their families would get more choice and flexibility and control over the supports and systems, supports and services that they needed. However, it stands to reason that if you make a system easier to use and you create more flexibility and choice, then that's going to have an impact on demand and expectation, and that's what the pilots and trials are revealing, particularly from a group of people who've come out of the woodwork, essentially, who've been entirely outside the system. But it's also revealing significant gaps for those people who are already experiencing the system, and of course for providers there are significant gaps between the funding they receive and the actual cost of the services that they're asked to provide.
Could you say how someone now has choice and flexibility? Could they literally ask for things that were going to make a difference rather than just have to take whatever was on the list provided?
Right. So what we see happening in the pilots is people are able to exercise that choice. Previously, they were offered a set menu which may approximate what they were after or may not meet their needs at all.
Are we talking equipment or therapy or support?
It could be a whole range of things.
Human
equipment,
support,
therapy,
yeah.
Access to different service programs and services. So it could be a whole range of things.
Was that capped financially in some way? Because, again, if you now have choice, does it necessarily make it more expensive? Or does it simply mean it's better tailored to what you need?
Well, certainly, there's the prospect of having things better tailored. However, it's the baseline funding that we're talking about. The system is coming off such a low base,
yeah,
it can't even afford to support those in the current system, let alone offer more choice and flexibility. And the pilots have systematically demonstrated this. When people have more flexibility and choice and control over what they need, it drives up expectation and it drives up demand.
Did it also result in and of itself in a cost increase or a cost blowout? Let's come in a moment to those who came for the first time. Did it also result in an increase in cost?
Well, I think the original assumptions that underpinned an enabling good lives approach and system transformation is that it would ultimately contain what were viewed as runaway costs.
Yeah. Because you could do more. You could be more independent, maybe work. Yeah.
But it's simply not demonstrating that. It's demonstrating that there are large numbers of people entirely out of the system who don't have access to services that they are more than likely eligible for. Plus, it drives up expectation and demand.
Right. Would you call it, in and of itself, again, if the funding could be there, would you call the redesign and the delivery of services in and of itself a success?
I think that the redesign is showing significant promise. I think the Enabling Good Lives principles themselves are an absolutely critical touchstone that we can use to determine what we need to do, what the changes need to be, and become a really important reference point to make sure that the changes that have been implemented are referenced back to those principles. But I guess we're sort of starting to wondering whether the government's priority is cost containment over the implementation of those principles through a transformed system. And I guess the question we're asking now is the government willing to invest the funds that are needed and the resources that are needed and match those with the outcomes that those Enabling Good Lives principles are seeking to achieve?
Now, what happened with the numbers of people coming forward to the system for the first time?
Well, they've been accepted into the system.
Yeah, but what was the experience? How did that unfold?
Well, in the redesign system, the system that's set up to engage with disabled people and families is much easier to use. In fact, it reaches out to disabled people and families. It uses much different language, and it uses words like flexibility, choice, and control, and those are words that readily appeal. So people who may not have known about the system before now know about it. Those who may have tried to use it but found it too difficult and bureaucratic and given up are coming back for another shot. And so combined, that's where that 25% comes from. However, what we do know is that those people that are in the system, and this is the challenge going forward, is that it's a constant battle to get an approximation of the funding and resources to match what you actually need. And it's those gaps that are accelerating. They're accelerating for the allocations that occur for disabled people and families, and the gap is accelerating in terms of the gap that funds organisations to provide services and their actual costs. And the system wasn't designed to ration access to services, but because of the limited funding, that's become a default position.
Is this exactly what this has exposed?
Yeah.
That intended or otherwise, the current system is rational?
So, exactly. So
now, let me just pause, because doesn't every component of the social system and the health system have to ration in the sense of there has to be some decisions made?
Absolutely.
So how do you define rationing?
Okay, so we absolutely accept that there can't be unlimited funding for disability support services, but what we are saying is the gap is really significant. And so the default position has evolved over a number of years, and I'm not even sure people who are part of that system recognise or reflect regularly on the sorts of processes that exist. And so the default position becomes one of minimising cost because things are really limited. So we're not asking for an open check here. We're asking for the gap to be closed so that the rationing of access to services is not as harsh and as systemic as it is at the moment, and to the extent that it creates real compromises in terms of the system's ability to meet basic needs of families and disabled people and the basic requirements of a quality and safe service for organisations providing those services.
You're saying the baseline funding of the disability sector is over $500 million a year short. So
yep.
That's year on year ongoing funding.
Yep.
How did you reach that figure?
Well, the $350 million of that is an extrapolation of that 25% that are missing out. So the current across the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Social Development, around 1.4 $4 billion is spent on supporting around 60,000 people. So we've extrapolated out from that. So if you roll out the trials across the country, as is at the moment, you would expect that 25% to systematically appear around the country, and that would be an additional $350 million for another 15,000 people who are not getting supported at the moment. On top of that, there's now a $210 million gap between the actual reasonable costs of providing a quality and safe service for organisations and the funding provided. So we've had year-on-year nil increases, and the prospect of a further year would be really debilitating for that sector. And organisations are now put in very, very difficult situations and dilemmas around continually saying yes to referrals and taking on new people with allocated packages of support where the maths simply doesn't add up.
What are you saying should happen then? What's been learned from this pilot that you see, if the funds are committed, is a solution?
Well, it's really important for government to start systematically linking the funding required to the outcomes that they want to achieve. And that's never been done before. The funding that's in the system at the moment has just grown in an ad hoc way over the years across the Ministry of Social Development and the Ministry of Health, and the funding is what the funding is. It's never been systematically linked to a discussion or a conversation around these are the outcomes we want to achieve for people using the system. If there's consensus on achieving those outcomes, what is a cost-effective way of doing that, and what are the funds that are needed?
So what are the three? You've got three immediate and three long-term solutions.
Yes, so we think there are some immediate solutions that are needed to provide some immediate fixes with the Budget 2020 in mind, and those are around closing the gap for organisations providing services in terms of contract price uplifts, so that those difficulties aren't there. We think it's really important that the government expand the capacity and the availability of employment support and community participation programs.
And that extra baseline funding
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Right. Yep. So that's for Budget 2020, but what's the long term?
Well, we also think there's something the government can do in the short term that won't in and of itself initially create need a lot more funding, and that is to have a much more flexible approach to contracting with organisations so that you can start rolling some of that flexibility out and unleash a lot of innovation that we know exists with those organisations.
So what prevents that now in the contracts?
Because everything is siloed into specific contract lines, residential services, supported living services, equipment.
You're talking bulk funding of individuals?
Yes.
Who would administer that?
Well, that would be administered largely by the Ministry of Health. But there is what's called a machinery of government review that is looking at where in the machinery of government should disability funding sit ultimately. And that's a review that's going alongside the demonstrations that are going on at the moment.
This presumably has gone to the relevant ministers.
Oh, yes.
You've been doing this for a long time.
Yes, we have.
How optimistic are you there'll be sizeable moves in 2020?
I think I'm reasonably optimistic. I think there is a strong recognition by government that there is a gap, and that they want to land some progress. I think there is a degree of support for more flexible contracting, and a willingness to look at rolling that out and not waiting until the end of next year or until the final evaluations of all these pilots are in.
We'll await the budget.
We will indeed.
Thank you, Garth Benny, Disability Support Network's Chief Executive.